Why with all that capital money? Weapons. And not just the ones laid out before him. He could buy guns. As if to confirm shady dealings, the woman broke off talking when he came into earshot. Sejanus joined him directly. Shopping? Coriolanus asked.
I was thinking of getting a pocket knife, said Sejanus. But she's out at the moment.
Perfect. A lot of the soldiers carried them. There was even a game they played when they were off duty, where they bet money on who could hit a target. I was thinking of getting one myself, once we get paid.
Of course, once we get paid, agreed Sejanus,
as if that had been understood. Suppressing an impulse to strike him, Coriolanus strode out of the hob without acknowledging Maud Ivory and Tam Amber. He barely spoke on the way back as he revised his strategy. He had to find out what Sejanus was mixed up in. Logic had failed to induce a confidence. Would intimacy work? It wouldn't hurt to try. A few blocks from the base, he laid a hand on Sejanus's shoulder, bringing them both to a stop. You know, Sejanus, I'm your friend. More than a friend, you're the closest thing I'll ever have to a brother, and there are special rules for family. If you need help, I mean, if you get into something you can't handle, I'm here. Tears welled up in Sejanus's eyes.
Thank you, Corio. That means a lot. You may be the only person in the world who I actually trust.
Ah, trust again. The air was full of it. Come here. He pulled Sejanus into an embrace. Just promise not to do anything stupid, okay? He felt him nod in assent, but knew the likelihood of his keeping that promise was almost nil. At least their busy schedule kept Sejanus under constant supervision, even when they left the base. Monday afternoon, they retrieved the traps from the trees again. Although they'd been undisturbed for the entire weekend, not one contained a mockingjay. Contrary to expectations, Dr. K seemed pleased by the birds. It seems they've inherited more than advanced mimicry. They've evolved their survival skills as well. Forget replacing the cages. We have plenty of jabberjays. Tomorrow, we'll try the mist nets.
By the time the soldiers got out of the trucks on Tuesday afternoon, the scientists had chosen locations with heavy mockingjay traffic. They broke into groups. Coriolanus and Bug were with Dr. K again, and helped erect sets of poles. Between each was stretched a finely woven mist net designed to capture the mockingjays. Nearly invisible, the nets began to yield results almost immediately, entangling the birds and dropping them into horizontal rows of pockets in their mesh surfaces. Dr. K had given instructions that the nets were never to be left unsupervised, and that the birds were to be removed immediately, to keep them from becoming too snarled and to make the experience as trauma-free as possible. She personally removed the first three mockingjays from their nets, carefully freeing the birds while holding them securely in her hand. When given the go-ahead, Bug proved to be a natural, gently untangling his mockingjay and placing it in a waiting cage. Coriolanus's bird began a tortured screaming the minute he touched it, and when he gave it a squeeze designed to dissuade it, it drove its beak into his palm. He reflexively dropped it, and in moments it had vanished into the foliage. Noxious creature. Dr. K cleaned and bandaged his hand, which reminded him of how Tigris had done the same on reaping day when the thorn on the Grand Mam's rose had punctured him, not even 2 months ago. What hopes he'd had that day, and now look at him. Rounding up mutt spawn in the districts. He spent the rest of the afternoon carrying the caged birds to the truck. The hand didn't excuse him from bird duty, though, and he resumed cleaning cages back at the hangar. Coriolanus began to warm up to the jabberjays. They really were impressive pieces of engineering. A few of the remotes lay around the lab, and the scientists allowed him to play with the birds once they'd been catalogued.
It won't hurt anything, one said. In fact, they seemed to enjoy the interaction.
Bug wouldn't participate, but when he grew bored, Coriolanus made them record silly phrases and sing bits of the anthem, seeing how many he could operate with one remote click. Up to four, sometimes, if their cages were close together. He always took care to erase them by doing a final quick recording in which he was silent, ensuring his voice would not end up back in the Citadel lab.
He stopped with the singing entirely when the mockingjays began to pick it up, even if there was a certain satisfaction in hearing them pipe out praise for the capital. He had no way to silence them, and they could string one melody out endlessly. On the whole, he was beginning to weary of the infusion of music into his life. Invasion might be a better word. It seemed to be everywhere these days. Bird song, covey song, bird and covey song. Perhaps he did not share his mother's love of music after all. At least such a quantity of it. It consumed his attention greedily, demanding to be listened to and making it hard to think. By mid-afternoon Wednesday, they'd collected 50 mockingjays in total, enough to satisfy Dr. K. Coriolanus and Bugs spent the rest of the day attending to the birds and shuttling the new mockingjays over to the lab table to be numbered and tagged. They finished before dinner and returned after to prepare the birds for travel to the capital. The scientists showed Coriolanus and Bug how to fasten the cloth covers on the cages, and then they relocated to the hovercraft, trusting the pair to take care of it. Coriolanus volunteered to do the covers while Bug carried the birds to the hovercraft and helped settle them in for their journey. Coriolanus started with the mockingjays, happy to see them go. He moved the cages one at a time to his work table, snapped on their covers, wrote the letter M and the bird's number in chalk on the cloth, and handed them off. Bug was just leaving with the 50th cage, which contained a madly chirping mockingjay, when Sejanus bounced in the door, sounding a bit hyper. "Good news! Another delivery from my ma!" Bug, who'd been down about the birds leaving, cheered up a bit.
"She's the best."
"I'll tell her you said so." Sejanus watched Bug move off and turned to Coriolanus, who just collected the jabberjay tagged with the number 1. The bird twittered away in its cage, still imitating the last mockingjay. Sejanus's grin had vanished, and an anguished expression had taken its place. His eyes swept the hangar to ensure they were alone, and he spoke in a hushed voice.
"Listen, we've only got a few minutes. I know you won't approve of what I'm going to do, but I need you to at least understand it. After what you said the other day, about us being like brothers, well, I feel I owe you an explanation. Please just hear me out."
This was it, then. The confession. Coriolanus's entreaties for sanity and caution had been weighed and found insufficient. Misguided passion had won the day. Now was the time for the pieces to be explained. The money. The guns. The base map. The moment the whole treasonous rebel plot would be revealed. Once Coriolanus heard it, he'd be as good as a rebel himself, a traitor to the capital. He should panic or run, or at least try to shut Sejanus up, but he did none of these things. Instead, his hands acted on their own. Like the time he dropped the handkerchief into the tank of snakes before he'd been aware of deciding to do it. Now his left hand adjusted the cover of the Jabberjay cage while his right, concealed from Sejanus's view by his body, dropped to the counter, where a remote sat. Coriolanus pressed record, and the Jabberjay fell silent. Chapter 28. Coriolanus turned his back to the cage, leaning on the table with his hands waiting. "It's like this," said Sejanus, his voice rising with emotion. "Some of the rebels are leaving District 12 for good, heading north to start a life away from Pan Am. They said if I help them with Lil, I can go too." As if questioning the claim, Coriolanus raised his eyebrows. Sejanus's words tumbled out. I know, but they need me. The thing is, they've determined to free Lil and take her with them. If they don't, the capital will hang her with the next lot of rebels they bring in. The plan is simple, really. The prison guards work in 4-hour shifts. I'm going to drug a couple of my ma's treats and give them to the outside guards. This medicine they gave me in the capital, it knocks you out like that. Sejanus snapped his fingers. I'll take one of their guns. The inside guards are unarmed, so I can force them into the interrogation room at gunpoint. It's soundproof, so no one can hear them yell. Then I'll get Lil. Her brother can get us through the fence. We'll head north immediately. We should have hours before they discover the guards. Since we're not going through the gate, they'll assume we're hiding on base, so they'll lock it down and search here first. By the time they figure it out, we'll be long gone. No one hurt, and no one the wiser. Coriolanus dropped his head and rubbed his brow with his fingertips, as if trying to collect his thoughts, unsure how long he could refrain from talking without seeming suspicious. But Sejanus hurried on.
I couldn't go without telling you. You're as good to me as any brother could be. I'll never forget what you did for me in the arena. I'll try to figure out some way to let Ma know what happened to me. And my father, I suppose. Let him know the plinth name lives on, if only in obscurity.
There it was. The plinth name. It was enough. His left hand found the remote and he pressed the neutral button with his thumb. The Jabberjay resumed the song it had been singing earlier. Something caught Coriolanus' eye.
Here comes Bug.
Here comes Bug, the bird repeated in his voice. Hush, you silly thing, he told the bird. Inwardly pleased, it had resumed its normal, neutral pattern. Nothing to alert Sejanus there. He quickly snapped the cloth in place and marked it with J1.
We need another water bottle. One broke, said Bug as he entered the hangar.
One broke, said the bird in Bug's voice, and then it began to imitate a passing crow. I'll find one. Coriolanus handed him the cage. As Bug left, Coriolanus crossed over to a bin where they kept supplies and began to dig around. Better to stay away from the other Jabberjays while the conversation continued. If they started mimicking too much, Sejanus might wonder why the first bird had been so silent. Not that he really knew how the birds worked. Dr. K had not explained that to the group at large.
It sounds crazy, Sejanus. So many things could go wrong.
Coriolanus rattled off a list. What if the guards don't want your ma's treats? Or one does and collapses with the other watching? What if the inside guards call for help before you get them in the room? What if you can't find the key to Lil's cell? And what do you mean her brother will get you through the fence? No one's going to notice him, what, cutting through it?
No, there's a weak spot in the fence behind the generator. It's already loose or something. Look, I know a lot of things have to go right, but I think they will.
Sejanus sounded as if he was trying to convince himself.
They have to. And if they don't, then they'll arrest me now instead of later, right? When I'm wrapped up in something worse?
Coriolanus shook his head unhappily.
I can't change your mind.
Sejanus was adamant.
No, I've decided. I can't stay here. We both know it. Sooner or later, I'll snap. I can't do the peacekeeping work in good conscience, and I can't keep endangering you with my crazy plans.
But how will you live out there? Coriolanus found a box with a new water bottle.
We have some supplies. I'm a good shot, said Sejanus.
He had not mentioned the rebels having guns, but apparently they did. And when the bullets run out?
We'll figure something out. Fish, net birds. They say there are people in the north, Sejanus told him.
Coriolanus thought of Billy Tope luring Lucy Gray to that imaginary outpost in the wilderness. Had he heard about it from the rebels, or had they heard about it from him?
But even if there aren't, there's no capital, Sejanus continued. And that's the main thing for me, isn't it? Not this district or that. Not student or peacekeeper, it's living in a place where they can't control my life. I know it seems cowardly running away, but I'm hoping that once I'm out of here, maybe I can think straighter and come up with some way I can help the districts.
Fat chance, thought Coriolanus. It will be amazing if you survive the winter. He pulled the water bottle from its packaging. Well, I guess all there is to say is I'll miss you, and good luck. He felt Sejanus moving in for an embrace when Bug came through the door. He held up the bottle.
Found one. I'll let you get back to work.
Sejanus gave a wave and left. Coriolanus went on mechanically covering and marking cages while his mind raced. What should he do? Part of him wanted to run to the hovercraft and erase Jabberjay number one, put it on play, then neutral, then record, then neutral again in swift succession so that it would have nothing memorized but the distant shouts of the soldiers on the tarmac. But then what would his options be? To try to dissuade Sejanus from his plan? He had no confidence that he could, and even if he did, it was only a matter of time before Sejanus came up with another scheme. To rat him out to the base commander? He would likely deny it, and as the only proof lay in the Jabberjay's memory bank, Coriolanus would have nothing to back up his accusation. He didn't even know the time of the breakout, so no trap could be set. And where would that leave him with Sejanus? Or if it got out, the entire base? As a snitch, an unreliable one at that, and a troublemaker? He'd taken care not to speak while the Jabberjay was recording so as not to incriminate himself in any way. But Dr. Gall would get the reference to the arena, and she would understand the taping had been intentional. If he sent the bird to the Citadel, she could decide how best to handle the matter. Probably she'd put in a call to Strabo Plinth, discharge Sejanus, and send him home before he did any damage. Yes, that would be best for everybody. He dropped the remote into the bin of bird supplies. If all went well, Sejanus Plinth would be out of his hair in a matter of days. The calm proved short-lived. Coriolanus awoke after a few hours' sleep from a terrible dream. He'd been in the stands of the arena looking down at Sejanus, who knelt beside Marcus's wrecked body. He was sprinkling it with breadcrumbs, unaware that a multicolored army of snakes was closing in on him from all sides. Coriolanus screamed at him over and over to get up, to run, but Sejanus didn't seem to hear. When the snakes reached him, he had plenty of screaming of his own to do. Guilt-ridden and slick with sweat, Coriolanus realized he had not thought through the ramifications of sending the Jabberjay. Sejanus could be in real trouble. He leaned over the side of his bunk and was reassured for a moment by the sight of Sejanus sleeping peacefully across the barrack from him. He was overreacting. Most likely, the scientists would never even hear the recording, let alone pass it on to Dr. Gall. Why would they bother to put the bird on play? There was no reason to, really. The Jabberjays had been tested at the hangar already. It had been a questionable act, but it would not result in Sejanus's death, by snakes or otherwise. That thought soothed him until he realized that, in that case, he was back to square one, and in great danger for knowing about the rebel plan. Lil's rescue, the escape, even the weak spot in the fence behind the generator weighed on him. That chink in the capital armor. The whole idea of the rebels having secret access to the base. It frightened and infuriated him. This breaking of the contract. This invitation to chaos and all that could follow. Didn't these people understand that the whole system would collapse without the capital's control? That they all might as well run away to the north and live like animals because that's what they'd be reduced to? It made him hope the Jabberjay delivered its message after all. But if the capital officials did, by chance, hear Sejanus's confession, what would they do to him? Would buying rebel guns to use against the peacekeepers be cause for execution? No, wait, he hadn't recorded anything about the illegal guns. Only the part about Sejanus stealing the peacekeepers. But that was bad enough. Maybe he was doing Sejanus a favor. If they caught him before he had a chance to act, maybe he could get prison time instead of a more severe sentence. Or, most likely, old Plinth would buy him out of whatever trouble he faced. Foot the bill for a new base for District 12. Sejanus would get kicked out of the peacekeepers, which would make him happy, and probably end up with a desk job in his father's munitions empire, which would not. Miserable, but alive. And most importantly, someone else's problem. Sleep evaded Coriolanus for the rest of the night, and his thoughts turned to Lucy Gray. What would she think about him if she knew what he'd done to Sejanus? She'd hate him, of course. Her and her love of freedom for the Mockingjays, for the Jabberjays, for the Covey, for everybody. She'd probably support Sejanus's escape plan entirely, especially since she'd been locked in the arena herself. He'd be a capital monster, and she'd run back to Billy Tope, taking with her what little happiness he had left. In the morning, he climbed down from his bunk, tired and irritable. The scientists had flown home to the capital the night before, leaving his squad to its dull routines. He dragged through the day, trying not to think about how, in a couple of weeks, he should be starting an education at the university with a full ride, choosing his classes, touring the campus, buying his books. As to the Sejanus dilemma, he'd accepted that no one would ever hear the Jabberjay's dispatch, and he should just corner him and throttle some sense into him. Threatened to report him to both the commander and his father, and carry through on that threat if he persisted. He'd had enough of the whole idiotic thing. Unfortunately, the day offered no opportunity to present his ultimatum. To make matters worse, Friday brought a letter from Tigris chock full of bad news. Prospective buyers and a lot of nosy people had been touring the Snows' apartment. They'd received two offers, both far below the amount they'd need to move to the most modest apartments Tigris had seen. The visitors distressed the grand ma'am, who camped among her rose bushes in a great show of denial when they appeared. However, she overheard one couple who were inspecting the roof, discussing how they could replace her beloved garden with a goldfish pond. The idea that the roses, the very symbol of the Snow dynasty, were to be demolished precipitated her downward spiral into even greater agitation and confusion. It was worrisome to leave her alone now. Tigris was at her wit's end and asking for advice, but what advice could he give? He had failed them in every possible way and could think of no road out of their despair. Anger, impotence, humiliation, those were all he had to offer. By Saturday, he almost looked forward to confronting Sejanus. He hoped it would come to blows. Someone should pay for the indignities of the Snow family, and who better than a plinth? Smiley Bug and Beanpole were as eager to go to the Hob as ever, although they were getting tired of spending Sundays recuperating. As they dressed for the evening out, the bunkmates decided to forego the white liquor for some fermented apple cider, which didn't pack as much punch but still gave the drinker a nice buzz. The question was academic for Coriolanus, who had no intention of imbibing at all. He wanted a clear head when he dealt with Sejanus. As they were leaving the barracks, they got roped into an extra detail by Cookie and spent half an hour unloading a hovercraft full of crates.
"You'll be glad about it next weekend. Commander's birthday party," he said, and slipped them a quart bottle of what turned out to be cheap whiskey.
It was a big improvement over the local brew. When they arrived at the Hob, they barely had time to grab some crates and squeeze into a spot against the back wall before Maud Ivory danced on stage to introduce the covey. Not great seats, but between Cookie's whiskey and the fact they could enjoy some of Ma's treats instead of trading them, no one felt the need to complain, although Coriolanus privately regretted missing his time with Lucy Gray in the shed. He placed his crate practically on top of Sejanus's so he would know if he tried to disappear again. Sure enough, about an hour into the show, he felt Sejanus rise and watched him move off toward the main door. Coriolanus counted to 10 before he followed, trying to attract as little attention as possible. But they were near the exit, and no one seemed to notice. Lucy Gray began a downbeat number, and the covey played mournfully behind her.
"You come home late, fall on your cot. You smell like something that money bought. We don't have cash, or so you say. So where did you get it, and how'd you pay? The sun don't rise and set for you. You think so, but you're wrong. You tell me lies, I can't stay true. I'll sell you for a song."
The song grated on him. It sounded like another Billy Taupe-inspired number. Why didn't she write something about him instead of dwelling on that nobody? He was the one who saved her life after Billy Taupe had bought her a ticket to the arena. Coriolanus stepped outside just in time to see Sejanus rounding the corner of the Hob. Lucy Gray's voice poured out into the night air as he skirted along the side of the building.
"You get up late? Won't say a word? You've been with her, that's what I've heard. I don't own you, so I've been told. But what do I do when the nights get cold? The moon don't wane and wax for you. You think so, but you're wrong. You cause me pain, you make me blue. I'll sell you for a song."
Coriolanus paused in the shadows at the back of the Hob as he watched Sejanus hurry through the open door of the shed. All five of the covey were on stage, so who would he be looking for? Was this a prearranged meeting with the rebels to lock down their escape plans? He had no desire to walk in on a whole nest of them, and he had just resolved to wait it out when the woman from the Hob, the one Sejanus had supposedly seen about the pocket knife, came out the door stuffing a wad of bills into her pocket. She disappeared down an alley, leaving the Hob behind. So that was it. Sejanus had come to give her money for weapons, most likely those guns he was planning to hunt with in the north. This seemed as good a time as any to confront him. while the contraband was still hot in his hands. He crept over to the shed, not wanting to startle Sejanus if he was handling a gun, his footsteps masked by the music.
You're here, you're not. It's more than me. It's more than you, it's more like we. They're young and soft, they worry so. You coming or going, they need to know. The stars don't shine and shoot for you. You think so, but you're wrong. You mess with mine, I'll hurt you too. I'll sell you for a song.
During the applause that followed, Coriolanus peered around the shed's open doorway. The only light came from a small lantern, the type he'd seen some of the coal miners holding at Arlo's hanging, positioned on a crate in the back of the shed. In its glow, he could make out Sejanus and Billy Tope crouched over a burlap sack, out of which protruded several weapons. As he took a step in, he froze, suddenly aware of the barrel of a shotgun positioned inches from the side of his ribcage. He drew in his breath and was beginning to raise his hand slowly when he heard the quick tap of shoes behind him and Lucy Gray's laughter. Her hands landed on his shoulders with a, "Hey, saw you slip out. Barb Azure said if you..." Then she tensed, aware of the gunman.
"Inside," was all he said.
Coriolanus moved toward the lamp with Lucy Gray holding tightly to his arm. He heard the cinder block scrape on the cement floor and the door shut behind them. Sejanus leaped to his feet.
"No, it's all right, Spruce. He's with me. They're both with me."
Spruce moved into the lamplight. Coriolanus recognized him as the man who had restrained Lil the day of the hanging, the brother Sejanus had mentioned, no doubt. The rebel looked them over.
"Thought we agreed this was between us."
"He's like my brother," said Sejanus. "He'll cover for me when we run, buy us more time."
Coriolanus had promised to do no such thing, but he nodded. Spruce redirected his barrel to Lucy Gray.
"What about this one?"
"I told you about her," said Billy Tope. "She's going north with us. She's my girl."
Coriolanus could feel Lucy Gray clench his arm, then drop it.
"If you'll take me," she said.
"You two aren't together?"
said Spruce, his gray eyes moving from Coriolanus to Lucy Gray. Coriolanus had been wondering this as well. Was she really going with Billy Tope? Had she been using him, as he'd suspected?
"He's seeing my cousin, Barb Azure. She sent me to tell him where to meet up tonight is all," said Lucy Gray.
So she just lied to defuse the moment, was that it? Still unsure, Coriolanus played along.
"That's right."
Spruce considered it, then shrugged and lowered the gun, releasing Lucy Gray from its hold.
"I guess you'll be company for Lil."
Coriolanus's eyes fell to the cache of weapons. Two more shotguns, a standard peacekeeper rifle like the ones they used in target practice, some sort of heavy piece that appeared to launch grenades, several knives.
"That's quite a haul."
"Not for five people," Spruce replied. "It's the ammo I'm concerned about. Be helpful if you could get us some more of that from the base."
Sejanus nodded. "Maybe. We don't really have access to the armory, but I can look around."
"Sure. Stock up."
Everyone's head snapped toward the sound, a female voice coming from the far corner of the shed. Coriolanus had forgotten about the second door since no one ever seemed to use it. In the pitch blackness outside the lamp's circle of light, he could not say if it was open or shut or make out the intruder. How long had she been hiding there in the gloom?
"Who's there?" said Spruce.
"Guns, ammo,"
mocked the voice.
"You can't make more of that, can you, up north?"
The nastiness helped Coriolanus place it from the night of the brawl in the hob.
"It's Mayfair Lip, the mayor's daughter."
"Trailing after Billy Tope like a hound in heat," said Lucy Gray under her breath.
"Always keep that last bullet somewhere safe, so as you can blow your brains out before they catch you," said Mayfair.
"Get home," ordered Billy Tope. "I'll explain this later. It's not how it sounded."
No.
come in and join us, Mayfair, invited Spruce. We've got no quarrel with you. You can't choose your pa.
We won't hurt you, said Sejanus.
Mayfair gave an ugly laugh.
Course you won't.
What's going on? Spruce asked Billy Tope.
Nothing. She's just talking, he said. She won't do anything.
That's me. All talk, no action, right, Lucy Gray? How'd you enjoy the capital, by the way?
The door gave a small creak, and Coriolanus had the sense Mayfair was backing away, about to flee. With her would go his entire future. No, more than that. His very life. If she reported what she'd heard, the whole lot of them would be as good as dead. In a flash, Spruce lifted his shotgun to shoot her, but Billy Tope knocked the barrel toward the floor. Coriolanus reflexively reached for the peacekeeper rifle and fired toward Mayfair's voice. She gave a cry, and there was the sound of her collapsing to the floor.
Mayfair!
Billy Tope bolted across the shed to where she lay in the doorway. He staggered back into the light, his hand shiny with blood, spitting at Coriolanus like a rabid animal.
What'd you do?
Lucy Gray began to shake, the way she had in the zoo when Arachne Crane's throat had been slit. Coriolanus gave her a push, and her feet started moving toward the door. Go back. Get on stage. That's your alibi. Go!
Oh, no. If I swing, she's swinging with me.
Billy Tope charged after her. Without hesitating, Spruce shot Billy Tope through the chest. The blast carried him backward, and he crumpled to the floor. In the stillness that followed, Coriolanus registered the music coming from the hob for the first time since Lucy Gray had finished her number. Maud Ivory had the entire warehouse caught up in a sing-along.
Keep on the sunny side. Always the sunny side.
You better do like he said, Spruce told Lucy Gray, before they miss you and someone comes looking.
Keep on the sunny side of life.
Lucy Gray couldn't take her eyes off Billy Tope's body. Coriolanus grabbed her by the shoulders, forcing her to look at him.
Go. I'll take care of this.
He propelled her to the door.
It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way.
She opened it, and they both looked out. The coast was clear.
If we keep on the sunny side of life. Yes, sir. Keep on the sunny side of life.
The whole hob broke into drunken cheers, signifying the end of Maud Ivory's song. They were just in time.
You were never here, Coriolanus whispered in Lucy Gray's ear as he let her go.
She stumbled across the pavement and into the hob. He slid the door shut with his foot. Sejanus checked Billy Tope's pulse. Spruce stuffed the weapons back into the burlap bag.
Don't bother. They're dead. I'm planning to keep this to myself. What about you two?
The same, obviously, said Coriolanus. Sejanus stared at them still in shock.
Him too. I'll make sure. You might think about coming with us.
Someone's going to pay for this, said Spruce. He retrieved the lamp and vanished out the back door, throwing the shed into darkness. Coriolanus fumbled forward until he found Sejanus and pulled him out after Spruce. He forced Mayfair's body into the shed with his boot and firmly closed the door on the murder scene with his shoulder. There. He'd successfully made it in and out of the shed without touching anything with his skin. Except the gun he'd killed Mayfair with, of course, no doubt covered in his fingerprints and DNA. But Spruce would take that when he left District 12, never to return. The last thing he needed was a repeat of the handkerchief scenario. He could still hear Dean Highbottom taunting him.
Do you hear that, Coriolanus? It's the sound of snow falling.
For a moment, he inhaled the night air. Music, some sort of instrumental piece, floated over to them. He guessed Lucy Gray had made it onto the stage, but had not yet reclaimed her voice. Grabbing Sejanus by the elbow, he steered him around the shed and checked the passage between the buildings. Empty. He hurried them down the side of the hob, pausing before they turned the corner.
Not a word, he hissed.
Sejanus, pupils wide, sweat staining his collar, repeated,
"Not a word."
Inside the hob, they took their seats. Next to them, Beanpole sat propped against the wall, apparently blacked out. On the other side of him, Smiley chatted up a girl while Bug killed the whiskey. No one seemed to have missed them. The instrumental ended, and Lucy Gray had pulled herself together enough to sing again, choosing a number that required all the covey to back her up. Smart girl. They would likely be the ones to discover the bodies, since the shed was their break room. The longer she kept them all together up there, the better their alibi would be. The more time Spruce would have to get those murder weapons out of the area, and the harder it would be for the audience to place anything in time. Coriolanus's heart pounded in his chest as he tried to assess the damage. He thought no one would care much about Billy Tope, except Clerk Carmine, maybe. But Mayfair? The only child of the mayor? Spruce was right. Someone was going to pay for her. Lucy Gray opened the floor to requests and managed to keep all five of the covey on stage for the rest of the program. Maud Ivory collected money from the audience as usual. Lucy Gray thanked everybody, the covey took a final bow, and the audience began to shuffle toward the door.
"We need to head straight back," Coriolanus said quietly to Sejanus.
They each threw one of Beanpole's arms over their shoulders and headed out with Bug and Smiley trailing behind. They traveled about 20 yards down the road when Maud Ivory's hysterical screams cut through the night air, causing everyone to turn back. Since it would have been suspicious to keep going, Coriolanus and Sejanus swung Beanpole around as well. Then very quickly, peacekeeper whistles blew, and a couple of officers were waving them back to the base. They lost themselves in the herd and did not speak to each other again until they'd reached the barrack, heard their bunkmates snoring, and snuck into the bathroom.
"We know nothing. That's the whole story," Coriolanus whispered. "We left the hob briefly to piss. The rest of the night, we were at the show."
"All right," said Sejanus. "What about the others?"
"Spruce is long gone, and Lucy Gray won't tell a soul, not even the covey. She won't want to put them in danger," he said. "Tomorrow, we'll both be hungover and spend the day on the base."
"Yes, yes, day on the base."
Sejanus seemed distracted to the point of incoherence. Coriolanus grasped his face between his hands. "Sejanus, this is life or death. You have to hold it together." Sejanus agreed, but Coriolanus knew he didn't sleep a wink after that. He could hear him shifting around the whole night through. In his own mind, he replayed the shooting again and again. He'd killed for the second time. If Bobbin's death had been self-defense, what was Mayfair's? Not premeditated murder. Not murder at all, really. Just another form of self-defense. The law might not see it that way, but he did. Mayfair may not have had a knife, but she had the power to get him hanged. Not to mention what she'd do to Lucy Gray and the others. Perhaps because he hadn't actually seen her die, or even had a good look at the body, he felt less emotional than when he'd killed Bobbin. Or perhaps the second killing was just easier than the first. At any rate, he knew that he'd shoot her again if he had it all to do over. And somehow, that supported the rightness of his actions. The next morning, even the hungover bunkmates made it to the mess hall for breakfast. Smiley got the scoop from his nurse friend, who'd been on duty at the clinic the night before, when they'd brought in the bodies.
"They're both locals, but one of them is the mayor's daughter. The other one's a musician or something, but not one that we've seen. They were shot dead in that garage behind the hob, right during the show. Only none of us heard it because of the music."
"Did they find who did it?" asked Beanpole.
"Not yet. These people aren't even supposed to have guns, but like I told you, they're floating around out there," Smiley said. "Killed by one of their own, though."
"How do they know that?" asked Sejanus.
Shut up, thought Coriolanus. Knowing Sejanus, he could be one step away from confessing to a crime he didn't even commit.
"Well, she said they think the girl was shot with a peacekeeper's rifle, probably an old one that got stolen during the war, and the musician was killed by some sort of shotgun the locals used for hunting. Probably two shooters," Smiley reported. "They searched the surrounding area and couldn't find the weapons. Long gone with the murderers, if you ask me."
Coriolanus's nerves unwound a bit, and he ate a forkful of pancakes. Who found the bodies?
That little girl singer. You know, the one in the pink dress?
Said Smiley.
Maud Ivory, said Sejanus. I think that's it. Anyway, she freaked out. They questioned the band, but when would they have had time to do it? They barely leave the stage. And anyway, no guns were found, Smiley told them. Shook them up pretty good, though. I guess they knew the musician guy somehow or other.
Coriolanus stabbed a link of sausage with his fork, feeling much improved. The investigation was off to a good start. Even so, it could still be bad for Lucy Gray, having the double motive of Billy Tope being her old flame and Mayfair having sent her into the arena. And once the arena was brought into it, could he be implicated? No one from 12 knew he was her new love except the Covey, and Lucy Gray would keep them quiet. Anyway, if she had a new love, why would either of them care about Billy Tope? They might want to kill Mayfair, though, as a form of revenge, and Billy Tope might try to defend her. Actually, that was not far from what had happened. But hundreds of witnesses could swear that Lucy Gray had been on stage for all but a brief period of the show. No guns had been found. It would be tough to prove her guilty. He would have to have patience, give things time to simmer down, but then they could be together again. In many ways, he felt closer to her than ever now that they had this new and unbreakable bond. In view of the past night's events, the commander locked down the base for the day. Not that Coriolanus had plans anyway. He would have to steer clear of the Covey for a while. He and Sejanus floated around trying to look normal, playing cards, writing letters, cleaning their boots. As they knocked the mud from the treads, Coriolanus whispered, "What about the escape plan? Is it still on?"
"I've no idea," Sejanus said. "The commander's birthday isn't until next weekend. That was the night we were supposed to go." "Corio, what if they arrest an innocent person for the murders?"
"Then our troubles are over," thought Coriolanus, but he only said, "I think it's highly unlikely, with no guns. But let's cross that bridge when we come to it." Coriolanus slept better that night. Monday, the lockdown ended, and the rumor mill claimed that the murders had to do with rebel infighting. If they wanted to kill each other, let them. The mayor came on base and pitched a fit to the commander about his daughter. But since he'd spoiled Mayfair rotten and let her run loose like a wildcat, the feeling was he had no one to blame but himself if she had been keeping time with a rebel. By Tuesday afternoon, the interest in the murders had died down to the extent that Coriolanus began to make plans for the future as he peeled potatoes for the next day's breakfast. The first thing was to ensure that Sejanus had given up on the escape plan. Hopefully the events at the shed had convinced him he was playing with fire. Tomorrow night they would have mopping detail together, so that would be the best time to confront him. If he didn't agree to abandon the breakout, Coriolanus would have no choice but to report him to the commander. Feeling resolved, he peeled with such zeal that he finished early, and Cookie let him off for the last half hour of his shift. He checked the mail and found a box from Pluribus, loaded with packets of strings for assorted musical instruments, and a kind note saying there was no charge. He put them in his locker, happy at the thought of how happy the Covey would be when it was safe enough to see them again. Maybe in a week or two if things continued to settle down. Coriolanus began to feel like his old self as he headed to the mess hall. Tuesday meant hash. He had a few extra minutes and went to pick up another can of powder for his rash, which had finally begun to heal. But as he came out of the clinic, a base ambulance pulled up. The back doors swung open and two medics pulled a man on a stretcher from the back. His blood-soaked shirt suggested he might be dead, but as they carried him inside, he turned his head. A pair of gray eyes landed on Coriolanus, who could not suppress a gasp.
"Spruce."
Then the doors swung shut, blocking him from view. Coriolanus got word to Sejanus after hours, but neither knew what it meant. Spruce had clearly mixed it up with the peacekeepers, but why? Had they connected him with the murders? Did they know about the escape plan? Had they found out about the gun purchase? What would he tell them now that they'd captured him? Wednesday breakfast
Smiley's reliable nurse let him know that Spruce had died from his wounds during the night. She didn't really know, but most people thought he'd been involved with the murders. Coriolanus went through the morning on autopilot, waiting for the other shoe to drop. At lunch, it did. A pair of military police officers came to their table in the mess and arrested Sejanus, who went without a word. Coriolanus tried to mirror his bunkmates' shocked faces. Obviously, he parroted, there'd been a mistake. Led by Smiley, they confronted the sergeant at target practice. "We'd just like to say that there's no way Sejanus committed those murders. He was with us all night."
"We never were apart," ventured Beanpole, as if he could have possibly known, blacked out as he'd been against the wall, but all of them backed him up.
"I appreciate your loyalty," said the sergeant, "but I think this is about something else."
A chill went through Coriolanus. Something else? Like the escape plan? Spruce didn't seem like he'd have spilled the news, especially because it could have affected his sister. No. Coriolanus felt certain his jabberjay had made it through to Dr. Gall, and this was the fallout. First Spruce's arrest, then Sejanus's. For the next 2 days, everything seemed to tumble forward, as he tried to reassure himself that this was in Sejanus's best interest, as the bunkmates pleased to see their friend were denied, as the detention stretched on. He kept waiting for Strabo Plinth to descend in a private hovercraft, negotiate a discharge, offer to upgrade the entire air fleet for free, and whisk his errant son back home. But did his father even know about Sejanus's predicament? This wasn't the academy where they called your parents if you messed up. As casually as possible, Coriolanus asked an older soldier if they were ever allowed to call home. Yes, everyone was allowed a biannual call, but only once they'd put in 6 months. All other correspondence had to be by mail. Not knowing how long Sejanus might be in lockup, Coriolanus scribbled a short note to Ma, generally informing her that Sejanus was in trouble and suggesting Strabo might want to make a few calls. He hurried over to mail it Friday morning, but was waylaid by a base-wide announcement calling all but essential personnel to the auditorium. There, the commander informed them that one of their own was to be hanged for treason that afternoon. One Sejanus Plinth.
It was so surreal, like a waking nightmare.
In drill practice, his body felt like a marionette being jerked here and there by invisible strings. When it ended, the sergeant called him forward, and everyone, his fellow recruits, Smiley, Bug, and Beanpole, watched while Coriolanus was given the order to attend the hanging to fill out the ranks. Back at the barrack, his fingers were so stiff he could hardly manipulate the uniform buttons, each one carrying the impression of the Capitol seal on its silver face. His legs had the same lack of coordination he associated with bomb time, but somehow he wobbled to the armory to collect his rifle. The other peacekeepers, none of whom he knew by name, gave him a wide berth in the truck bed. He was certain he was tainted by association with the condemned. As with Arlo's hanging, Coriolanus was instructed to stand in a squad flanking the hanging tree. The size and volatility of the crowd confused him. Surely Sejanus had not garnered this sort of support in a few weeks. Until the peacekeeper van arrived and both Sejanus and Lil stumbled out in their chains. At the sight of the girl, many in the crowd began to wail her name. Arlo, an ex-soldier toughened by years in the mines, had managed a fairly restrained end, at least until he'd heard Lil in the crowd. But Sejanus and Lil, weak with terror, looked far younger than their years, and only reinforced the impression that two innocent children were being dragged to the gallows. Lil, her shaking legs unable to bear her weight, was hauled forward by a pair of grim-faced peacekeepers who would probably spend the following night trying to obliterate this memory with white liquor. As they passed him, Coriolanus locked eyes with Sejanus, and all he could see was the 8-year-old boy on the playground, the bag of gumdrops clenched in his fist. Only this boy was much, much more frightened. Sejanus's lips formed his name, Corio, and his face contorted in pain. But whether it was a plea for help or an accusation of his betrayal, he couldn't tell.
The peacekeepers positioned the condemned side by side on the trap doors. Another tried to read out the list of charges over the shrieks of the crowd, but all Coriolanus could catch was the word treason. He averted his eyes as the peacekeepers moved in with the nooses, and he found himself looking at Lucy Gray's stricken face. She stood near the front in an old gray dress, her hair hidden in a black scarf, tears running down her cheeks as she stared up at Sejanus. As the drum roll began, Coriolanus squeezed his eyes shut, wishing he could block out the sound as well. But he could not, and he heard it all. Sejanus's cry, the bang of the trap doors, and the Jabberjays picking up Sejanus's last word, screaming it over and over into the dazzling sun.
Ma! 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 Ma!
Chapter 29. Coriolanus soldiered his way through the aftermath, remaining stone-faced and speechless as he traveled back to the base, returned his gun, and walked to the barrack. He knew people were staring at him. Sejanus was known to be his friend, or at least a member of his squad. They wanted to see him crack, but he refused to give them the satisfaction. Alone in his room, he slowly removed his uniform, hanging each piece with precision, smoothing the creases with his fingers. Away from prying eyes, he allowed his body to deflate, his shoulders to droop in fatigue. All he'd managed to get down today had been a few swallows of apple juice. He felt too debilitated to rejoin his squad for target practice, to face Bug and Beanpole and Smiley. His hands shook too badly to hold a rifle anyway. Instead, he sat on Beanpole's bunk in his underwear in the stifling room, waiting for whatever was to come. It was only a matter of time. Maybe he should just give himself up, before they came to arrest him because Spruce had confessed to, or more likely, Sejanus had divulged the details of the murders. Even if they had not, the peacekeeper's rifle was still out there, covered in his DNA. Spruce had not fled to freedom, probably lying low until he could rescue Lil, and if he had remained in District 12, so had the murder weapons. They could be testing his gun right at this minute, looking for confirmation that Spruce had used it to kill Mayfair, and discovering that the shooter was their own private Snow, the one who'd ratted out his best friend and sent him to the gallows. Coriolanus buried his face in his hands. He had killed Sejanus as surely as if he'd bludgeoned him to death like Bobbin or gunned him down like Mayfair. He'd killed the person who considered him his brother. But even as the vileness of the act threatened to drown him, a tiny voice kept asking, "What choice did you have?" What choice? No choice. Sejanus had been bent on self-destruction, and Coriolanus had been swept along in his wake, only to be deposited at the foot of the hanging tree himself. He tried to think rationally about it. Without him, Sejanus would have died in the arena, prey to the pack of tributes who had tried to kill them as they fled. Technically, Coriolanus had given him a few more weeks of life, and a second chance, an opportunity to mend his ways, but he hadn't. Couldn't. Didn't care to. He was what he was. Maybe the wilderness would have been best for him. Poor Sejanus. Poor, sensitive, foolish, dead Sejanus. Coriolanus crossed to Sejanus's locker, removed his box of personal items, and sat on the floor, spreading the contents in front of him. The only addition since his first search were a couple of homemade cookies covered in a bit of tissue. Coriolanus unwrapped one and took a bite. Why not? The sweetness spread across his tongue, and images flashed in his brain. Sejanus holding out a sandwich at the zoo. Sejanus standing up to Dr. Gall. Sejanus embracing him on the road back to the base. Sejanus swinging from the rope.
Ma! 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 Ma!
He gagged on the cookie, bringing up a splash of apple juice, sour and acidic, along with the crumbs. Sweat poured off his body and he began to cry. Leaning back against the lockers, he curled his legs into his chest and let the ugly, violent sobs shake him. He wept for Sejanus, and for poor old Ma, and for sweet, devoted Tigress and his feeble, delusional grandmam,
who would soon be losing him in such a sordid way, and for himself, because any day now he would be dead. He started gasping for air in terror, as if the rope already choked the life from his body. He did not want to die, especially not in that field, with those mutant birds echoing his last utterance. Who knew what crazy thing you'd say in a moment like that? And him dead, and the birds screaming it all out until the mockingjays turned it into some macabre song. After about 5 minutes, the outburst ended, and he calmed himself, rubbing his thumb over the cool marble heart from Sejanus's box. There was nothing to do except try to face his death like a man, like a soldier, like a snow. Having accepted his fate, he felt the need to get his affairs in order. He had to make what small amends he could to those he loved. Unfastening the back of the silver picture frame, he found quite a bit of cash still remained after Sejanus's gun purchase. He took one of the creamy, fancy envelopes Sejanus had brought from the capital, stuffed the money in, sealed it, and addressed it to Tigris. After tidying Sejanus's keepsakes, he returned the box to his locker. What else? He found himself thinking of Lucy Gray, the one and now only love of his life. He would like to leave her a remembrance of him. He dug through his own box and decided on the orange scarf, since the covey loved color, and her more than most. He was unsure of how he'd get it to her, but if he made it to Sunday, maybe he could sneak off the base and see her one last time. He placed the neatly folded scarf with the strings Pluribus had sent. After rinsing the snot and tears from his face, he dressed and walked over to the post office to mail the money home. At dinner, he whispered an account of the hanging to his miserable bunkmates, trying to soften it. I think he died immediately. He couldn't have felt any pain. I still can't believe he did it, said Smiley. Beanpole's voice quavered. I hope they don't think we were all involved. Bug and I are the only ones who'd be suspected of being rebel sympathizers, being from the districts, said Smiley. What are you worried about? You guys are capital.
So was Sejanus, Beanpole reminded him. But not really, right? The way he always talked about District 2, said Bug.
No, not really, agreed Coriolanus.
Coriolanus spent the evening on guard duty at the empty prison. He slept like the dead, which made sense since it was only a matter of hours before he joined them. He went through the motions during morning drills and almost felt relief when at the end of lunch, Commander Hoff's aide appeared and requested that he follow him. Not as dramatic as the military police, but as they were trying to reinstate a sense of normalcy among the troops, it was the right way to proceed. Sure that he would be taken straight from the commander's office to the prison, Coriolanus regretted not placing some bit of home in his pocket to hang on to in his last hours. His mother's powder would have been the thing, something to soothe him while he waited for the rope. While not grand, the commander's office proved nicer than any other space he'd seen on base, and he sank into the leather seat across the desk from Hoff, grateful that he could receive his death sentence with a little class.
Remember, you're a snow, he told himself. Let's go out with some dignity.
The commander excused his aide, who left the office and closed the door behind him. Hoff leaned back in his chair and considered Coriolanus for a long moment.
Quite a week for you.
Yes, sir.
He wished the man would just get on with the interrogation. He was too tired to play some cat-and-mouse game.
Quite a week, repeated Hoff.
I understand you were a stellar student back in the capital.
Coriolanus had no idea who he'd heard that from, and wondered if it could have been Sejanus, not that it mattered.
That's a generous assessment.
The commander smiled.
And modest, too.
Oh, just arrest me, thought Coriolanus. He didn't need some long wind-up to what a disappointment he turned out to be.
I'm told you were close friends with Sejanus Plinth, said Hoff.
Ah, here we go, thought Coriolanus. Why not speed the thing along instead of dragging it out with denials?
We were more than friends. We were like brothers.
Hoff gave him a sympathetic look.
Then all I can do is express the capital's sincerest gratitude for your sacrifice.
Wait, what? Coriolanus stared at him in confusion.
Sir?
Dr. Gall received your message from the Jabberjay, Hoff reported. She said sending it couldn't have been an easy choice for you to make. Your loyalty to the capital came at a great personal cost.
So, a reprieve.
Apparently the gun with his DNA had not yet surfaced. They viewed him as a conflicted capital hero. He adopted a suffering look as befitted a man who grieved for his wayward friend. Sejanus wasn't bad, just confused.
I agree. But conspiring with the enemy crosses a line we can't afford to ignore, I'm afraid.
Hoff paused in thought.
Do you think he could have been mixed up in the murders?
Coriolanus's eyes widened as if the idea had never crossed his mind.
The murders? You mean at the Hob? The mayor's daughter and...
The commander flipped through some papers, then he decided not to bother.
That other fellow.
Oh, I don't think so. Do you think they're connected? Asked Coriolanus, as if mystified.
I don't know. Don't care much, Hoff told him. The young man was running with the rebels, and she was running with him. Whoever killed them probably saved me a lot of trouble up the road.
It doesn't sound like Sejanus, said Coriolanus. He never wanted to hurt anyone. He wanted to be a medic.
Yes, that's what your sergeant said, Hoff agreed. So, he didn't mention getting them guns?
Guns?
Not that I know of. How would he get guns?
Coriolanus was beginning to enjoy himself a bit.
Buy them on the black market? He's from a rich family, I hear, said Hoff. Well, never mind. It's likely to remain a mystery, unless the weapons turn up. I've got Peacekeeper searching the seam over the next few days. In the meantime, Dr. Gall and I have decided to keep your help with Sejanus quiet for your safety. Don't want the rebels targeting you, do we?
That's what I would prefer, anyway, said Coriolanus. It's hard enough dealing with my decision privately.
I understand. But when the dust settles, remember you did a real service for your country. Try to put it behind you.
Then, as if as an afterthought, he added,
It's my birthday today.
Yes, I helped unload some whiskey for the party, said Coriolanus.
Usually a good time. Try and enjoy yourself.
Hoff stood up and extended his hand. Coriolanus rose and shook it. I'll do my best. And happy birthday, sir. The bunkmates greeted him with delight when he returned, ambushing him with questions about the commander's calling him in. He knew Sejanus and I had a history together, and he just wanted to make sure I was all right, Coriolanus told them. The news improved everyone's spirits, and the update to their afternoon schedule gave Coriolanus some satisfaction. Instead of shooting at targets, they were cleared to take out the Jabberjays and Mockingjays at the Hanging Tree. Their chorus following Sejanus' final outcry had been the last straw. Coriolanus felt giddy as he blasted the Mockingjays off the branches, managing to kill three.
Not so clever now, are you? He thought.
Unfortunately, most of the birds flew out of range after a short while. But they'd be back. He'd be back, too, if he didn't hang first. In honor of the commander's birthday, they all showered, then dressed in fresh fatigues before heading over to the mess hall. Cookie had laid out a surprisingly elegant meal, serving up steak, mashed potatoes and gravy, and fresh, not canned, peas. Each soldier got a big mug of beer, and Hoff was on hand to cut an enormous frosted cake. After dinner, they all assembled at the gymnasium, which had been decorated with banners and flags for the occasion. Whiskey flowed freely, and many impromptu toasts were made over the mic brought out for this purpose. But Coriolanus didn't realize there would be entertainment until some of the soldiers started setting up chairs.
Sure, an officer told him. We hired that band from the Hob. The commander gets a kick out of them.
Lucy Gray. This would be his chance, probably his only chance to see her again. He ran to the barrack, retrieved the box from Pluribus with the instrument strings and his scarf, and hurried back to the party. He could see that his bunkmates had saved a chair for him about halfway up, but he stood at the back of the audience. If an opportunity came, he didn't want to make a scene getting out.
The lights flickered off in the main part of the gym, leaving only the area by the mic illuminated, and the crowd grew quiet. All eyes were on the locker room, which had been hung with the blanket the Covey used in the hob. Maud Ivory scampered out in a buttercup yellow dress with a wide skirt and hopped up on a crate someone had set in front of the mic.
"Hey there, everybody! Tonight is a special night, and you know why. It's somebody's birthday!"
The peacekeepers broke into raucous applause. Maud Ivory began to sing the old standby birthday song, and everyone joined in.
"Happy birthday to someone special, and we wish you many more. Once a year, we give a cheer to you, Commander Hoff. Happy birthday!"
It was the only verse, but they sang it three times while the Covey, one by one, took their places on stage. Coriolanus drew in a sharp breath when Lucy Gray appeared in the rainbow dress from the arena. Most people would think it was for the commander's birthday, but he felt certain that it was for him. A way to communicate, to bridge the chasm that circumstance had dug between them. An overwhelming flush of love ran through him at her reminder that he was not alone in this tragedy. They were back in the arena, fighting for survival, just the two of them against the world. He felt a bittersweet pang at the thought of her watching him die, but gratitude that she would survive. He was the only one left who could place her at the murders. She hadn't touched the weapons. Whatever happened to him, there was comfort in knowing she would live on for the both of them. For the first half hour, he didn't take his eyes off her, as the Covey ran through some of their regular numbers. Then the rest of the band cleared out, leaving her alone in the light. She settled in on a high stool and then, had he imagined it, patted the pocket of her dress as she had in the arena. It was her signal that she was thinking of him, that even if they were separated by space, they were together in time. Every nerve tingling, he listened intently as she began an unfamiliar song.
"Everyone's born as clean as a whistle, as fresh as a daisy, and not a bit crazy. Staying that way's a hard row for hoeing, as rough as a briar, like walking through fire. This world, it's dark, and this world, it's scary. I've taken some hits, so no wonder I'm wary. It's why I need you. You're pure as the driven snow."
Oh no, he had not imagined anything. The mention of snow confirmed it. She'd written this song for him.
"Everyone wants to be like a hero, the cake with the cream, or the doer, not dreamer. Doing's hard work. It takes some to change things, like goat's milk to butter, like ice blocks to water. This world goes blind when children are dying. I turn into dust, but you never stop trying. It's why I love you. You're pure as the driven snow."
His eyes filled with tears. They would hang him, but she would be there, knowing he was still a genuinely good person. Not a monster who'd cheated or betrayed his friend, but someone who'd really tried to be noble in impossible circumstances. Someone who had risked everything to save her in the games. Someone who'd risked it all again to save her from Mayfair. The hero of her life.
"Cold and clean, swirling over my skin, you cloak me, you soak right in, down to my heart."
To her heart.
"Everyone thinks they know all about me. They slap me with labels. They spit out their fables. You came along, you knew it was lying. You saw the ideal me. And yes, that's the real me. This world, it's cruel, with troubles aplenty. You asked for a reason. I've got 23. For why I trust you. You're pure as the driven snow."
Had there been any doubt, this confirmed it. 23, 23, the number of tributes she'd survived in the games, all because of him.
"That's why I trust you."